Welcome back to What's at Risk. I'm Mike Christian.
The meltdown of the financial sector in 2008 took the world by surprise. Yet credit crises have been part of the human experience since before the birth of Christ. Even in the best times of the Roman Republic, a span of about two centuries, there were about a half dozen credit crises. However, unlike ancient times, the sharp line of demarcation between money and credit has practically dissolved. With currency created at the click of a mouse or produced in a quantity when the central bank credits its balance sheet in exchange for government debt, mortgages, or the equally formless currency of other nations, an era of endless money was born.
Where's the money?
Where's the money?
Where's the money?
Where's the money if you never ever give me nothing else?
Where's the money? Just put it here and let me help myself.
In his new book, Endless Money, William Baker, a financial professional with more than 25 years of experience in investment research and equity portfolio management, examines how the U.S. government and the country's financial systems have embraced the socialization of income and credit and why this is so dangerous. William Baker is the founder of Gaineswood Investment Management, where he has managed money since 1996. He has over 25 years of investment experience, including as a portfolio manager for Oppenheimer Funds. Baker received his master's in business administration from Dartmouth College and a BA in economics from the University of Pennsylvania.
Crisis in the credit system. I found a bubble inside a crisis, a hole full of emptiness. In the credit system, I found a bubble inside a crisis, alone with my own distress.
With all of the currency financial instability, there's a lot of talk about international financial reform, and one idea proposed by some is a return to the gold standard. What exactly is that? It's a monetary system in which paper notes are backed by gold. That is to say, the notes simply represent the gold that you own and can be converted into fixed quantities of gold freely. Such a system stands in contrast to fiat currency, which is a currency with no guaranteed value in gold. A fiat currency has no intrinsic value, but the government declares it to be legal tender.
Good as gold. That's what everyone was told about the paper crap we sold. Troubled assets. Who will buy certificates piled to the sky? All we did was shrink the pie. Troubled assets.
One of the main benefits of the gold standard is that it protects citizens from hyperinflation and the debasing of the currency through excessive government spending. With a fiat currency, a government can print as much new money as it likes to pay for spending. This leads to a gradual decline in the value of the currency and the citizens' savings.
Let us pause in life's pleasures and count its many tears while we all sup sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Oh, hard times come again no more. It's a song, a sigh of the weary. Hard times come again no more. Many days you have lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times come again no more. Oh, hard times come again no more.
In 1966, Alan Greenspan said, "Under the gold standard, a free banking system stands as the protector of an economy's stability and balanced growth. The abandonment of the gold standard made it possible for the welfare status to use the banking system as a means to an unlimited expansion of credit. In the absence of the gold standard, there is no way to protect savings from confiscation through inflation."
Does anyone here have a poor credit history? Yeah, I don't know when I'm going to pay them back, but it's going to be soon. Super soon, I'm totally going to pay it back. Super soon. I really think before giving me a credit card, they really should have given me a math test. Like a series of story problems. Question number one. If Maria works as a comedian for $100 a week but spends $20 a day on hair scrunchies, how many years will it take for her to pay off a Taco Bell gordita she bought in 1992?
And John Maynard Keynes, the father of modern economics, similarly stated, "By a continuous process of inflation, governments can confiscate, secretly and unobserved, an important part of the wealth of their citizens. By this method, they not only confiscate, but they confiscate arbitrarily. And while the process impoverishes many, it actually enriches some."
Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Talking about a revolution. Talking about a revolution, oh, oh, no. Talking about a revolution, oh, oh, no.
The problem with the gold standard system is that a country's gold reserves are limited, and in times of crisis, when countries need a critical supply of money, gold can run out. A fiat currency, on the other hand, can be produced when needed. And even though this decreases the relative value of the currency, it provides the country with a supply of needed money.
We're speaking with William Baker, the author of Endless Money, The Moral Hazards of Socialism. So, Bill, in the wake of the recent credit crisis, we're staring at growing deficits and higher taxes. Is our leadership just postponing the real effects of this financial debacle that we just went through?
Yeah, I think so. I see it as essentially a credit problem to begin with, and we're solving it by adding more debt and trying to encourage people to spend more to get further into debt. Furthermore, the government's trying to spend more to make up for what individuals don't want to spend. So yeah, I do. I see it as a continuation here.
And really just pushing the real consequences of this out into the future?
That's true, yeah. I mean, I'm also a student of history, and, you know, in the book that I just had published, I salted with a lot of historical examples, and, you know, you can go back and look at credit crises in the past, and it is within government's power to defer the effects sometimes, and so that's what we're seeing right now is what I believe.
You write in your book that socialism is now embedded in both the income and the credit sides of our economy. Can you explain that a little bit?
You know, what we're seeing now in the credit markets, the problem arose really largely because, you know, real estate is the most prevalent asset out there in the banking system that's being financed. And we had a policy which is trying to subsidize one group of buyers, the lower income buyers, which is a form of socialism, by giving them a subsidy to buy and, you know, keeping low interest rates, having the government act as a co-signer for loans, and also by changing, you know, the regulations to make low doc and no doc loans possible and forcing banks to issue shaky loans. So you had political policies that triggered a lot of this. So that's how the socialism sort of enters the financial markets. And even today, now you're seeing basically, you know, think of them as central planners as if you were in the Russian system. You know, you have the Fed and you have the Treasury, and they're acting to take steps such as to nationalize the agencies, you know, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, and then also to set interest rates at zero, which is basically a tax on you know, a lot of the people that I talk to who might be in their 60s or 70s who have all their money in savings accounts and are planning to live off of the income from that and have a safe investment. You're taxing them completely to subsidize borrowers. You know, Main Street actually bailed out Wall Street, and I see that as a subsidy, you know, taking from one group and giving to another. And although, you know, you think of Wall Street as being affluent, right?
Yeah.
So actually one of the wrinkles of the book is that I think that the elites, very, very much on the top, a great number of them, and I kind of document the numbers of them, are very left-leaning and kind of align with the socialist philosophy to take from the middle class and the upper middle class, which I think is being pressured with extremely high tax rates and ordinary income.
That's a good point in terms of the middle class. The middle class in the scenario you just described really gets squeezed. Does the middle class even exist out into the future if we keep doing what we're doing?
Well, you know, I don't want to be too alarmist. You know, it's not like it goes poof in the year 2010 or something like that. But, you know, again, I go back to these historical analogies and you see how this has happened before. You know, in the Roman times, the aristocracy coupled with the bread and circuses sort of socialism policies and squeezed out the middle class through a number of regulations and policies. I think it could happen here. I think it is happening here. And I guess what's unique about the book, too, is I combine this knowledge of how a fiat currency works, where you basically have the government printing money endlessly, you know, as the title of the book suggests. That combines with the tax code to really set up almost an exemption for the billionaire elite class from taxation, and then all of the burden, you know, lies with this middle class who's paying, you know, all in state and federal rates of, you know, close to 50%, and then if they are lucky enough to amass any wealth, you know, a couple $1 million or something, then the estate tax starts kicking in after that if they die.
Not a pretty scenario. It seems to me in history that those types of things are followed closely by a revolution. We think about the French Revolution and the American Revolution, for that matter, right?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting concept, and in fact, there is a school of thought out there where you could explain almost all changes in empires and you know, countries that ascended and then descended, this all happened due to taxation, you know, that there's a stage, a republic stage, where you begin and then you develop this socialistic or you know, fascist kind of situation where, you know, you have an elite ruling and very high tax rates and then, you know, suddenly a better opportunity happens. Rome didn't fall, you know, it wasn't exactly conquered. It was more like the people in the Roman Empire preferred the new leadership.
Right.
Know, not to get into too much detail on that, but you can see it over and over again. Taxes can explain a lot of things.
Yeah.
It can explain the Civil War, you know, for example.
Now, Howard Dean said in a recent speech that capitalism should be blended with socialism. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's what's happening, and I think it is being blended, but I think there's a sort of error of thinking here. I mean, clearly, when we blended some capitalism into the Chinese economy and into the Russian economy, we saw good things happen. But it doesn't follow that it works in the opposite direction when you blend socialism in with capitalism. You know, you really screw things up royally. And you can, again, go back to a lot of these, you know, historical examples, but you started to see socialism rise in Europe as early as the mid-19th century, and there were, you know, collapses in the government bond markets when, you know, the governments over there were spending on railroads and various things and raising taxes, and then all of a sudden, you know, it was untenable and the governments were deemed by the marketplace to be broke. And, you know, you think about it, you look at what's happening in the United States. We've got high taxes, we've got heavy government spending, and it's very focused taxation on the middle class. You know, you got $12 trillion of debt, and you got about 6.5 million households in the top three brackets who are responsible for paying all the tax. If you do the division, it's pretty simple. It's, you know, it's at least 1.5 million per household in debt that those households that are expected to pay the tax are And then all the other people who are filing returns are very lightly taxed. So, you know, basically we're technically bankrupt.
But seriously, I know Americans are worried about more than whether or not I get a shoe in the face. They're worried about their lives, their jobs, their economies. And I understand it. It makes sense. I'm just worried that I'm going to get the blame for that, too. They say I let the USA start to run amok. We spent way too much money, and now with the bill you're stuck. It's all because some bankers ruined our economy. So I'm out here hoping that you all won't blame it all on me. Should have gone to freecreditreport.com. I could have seen those Wall Street boys were a bunch of ticking bombs. We could have checked their credit and seen that their loans don't work. Instead, we end up bailing out a bunch of greedy jerks. Yeehaw! America.
I'm having troubles financially. Got a call from Citibank Visa. Those people ask stupid questions, don't they? They're like, excuse me, we've noticed you're 90 days late in your account. We're wondering if there's a reason you haven't made a payment. Yeah, there's a reason. I don't have any money. Then they always say the same thing. Well, then why do you keep using the credit card? Because I don't have any money. Now don't call here anymore. Nothing's going to change. Then I get this letter in the mail. They say they're going to raise my credit limit. Who the hell is working in that department? Somebody shuffling papers on the top floor going, hey, look. This guy hasn't paid off the t-shirt he bought at Big Lots 4 years ago. Let's give him another couple grand, see what he does with it, what he does. The guy's a real Charlie Schwab this way.
Too many people need me. I've got so much to do. But when my traveling is over, I'll be back with interest.
We're back with Bill Baker, the author of Endless Money.
Do you think there's any positives in the recent government interventions in AIG and in the banking industry and the auto industry? Is there anything positive about that, or is that just exacerbating the same situation you're talking about?
Well, you know, I won't deny that it's always possible that one of these interventions, you know, can help. I mean, Chrysler was turned around and it was relaunched as a public company. So it's not impossible for the government to do something correct. But, you know, there's a long list of evidence of how they've screwed up in running private businesses. And unfortunately, you know, going back to the crux of the problem here is real estate and Freddie and Fannie. You know, we were told a year ago that when, or a year and a half ago, when they took them over, that temporarily their balance sheets would expand to help out, but then they'd start reducing them and phasing them down, slimming them down by December of 2009. Well, here we are in December 2009, and their programs are expanded, and this is a mechanism to bypass Congress and just open the sluice gate. And I just saw a report this morning, someone forecasting a big increase in housing starts for 2010. And that's what happens when you offer, you know, virtually 100% financing through the income tax credit for first-time home buyers with government-subsidized low mortgage rates and, you know, the Fed intervening and buying nearly 100% of all the mortgages issued in the marketplace in 2009. You know, you can add to the supply of houses while we already have an excess supply, you know. So I don't really have a lot of faith in these solutions.
What about the boost that it would give to the economy just in terms of bolstering the building industry and all the other associated aspects that would go
well,
with that?
Well, yeah, you know, no question. You can, you know, create jobs and everything. But then what do you have? You have a whole pile of extra debt, so you're pushing the problem out. I won't deny that you could kickstart things and kick the can down the road for another year or two. That's possible. But, you know, you're also fighting, you know, the government doesn't actually control every single dollar that's circulating out there in the economy. And there are people who are rebelling against this trend out of their own self-interest. And I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen, for example, a $1.3 trillion added to bank reserves by the Fed this year, and you know, starting from actually from October or so last year. And yet the broad money supply has only increased, this is M3, has only increased by about $250 billion. Well, what, you know, what happened to the other trillion?
Right.
You know, there, people are paying down debt. People are doing the things that government, you know, not necessarily wants them to do in this Keynesian and monetary stimulus two-pronged solution.
So from your perspective, I think we've clearly identified some of the issues here. What would you do? How would you get us out of this over the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, you know, my thought is this has been so long in coming that, you know, you do have certain moral obligations. You have an obligation to depositors. You've also made big promises and entitlements. And, you know, there are old people who are trying to live off of these programs. So you have to craft something to get you out of this. The only way I can see is you know, sort of a one-time debasement of the dollar. And the only way you could do that without creating an Argentina-like situation is that you would have to promise that it would come to an end with a full stop. And the only way to do that is to say that, you know, the government would stand by and be ready to exchange dollars for gold at some point, at some price. And it doesn't have to be a predetermined price. It can be flexible over time. And this is a solution that I'm pretty sure would work. It isn't the ideal solution. I mean, ideally, I think we should have a 100% gold standard. But, you know, realistically, some kind of, you know, maintenance of the fractional reserve system with exchangeability might be a, you know, a half-decent step. But, you know, I'm willing to consider that.
And so what happens if we follow your advice? What are the consequences of that in the short term and the long term?
The short term, I mean, basically you would have a, you'd be acknowledging the loss of wealth that we've had, basically. And it would hurt creditors and it would help borrowers. But that's, you know, you wouldn't want to go overboard with that because it would, you're in a tough situation. But I just can't see how penalizing somebody who has a deposit at a bank makes any sense, you know, because the alternative, if you went to a 100% gold solution right now, is you would have a collapse in all the banks and be really a giant mess. And, you know, creditors theoretically would be happy, but the asset value backing their credit would be so reduced by the deflation that you'd have. They'd be in the same boat. You know? But I think you would fix things a lot. I mean, I think you'd balance trade and create jobs here that have been missing as, you know, the economy's been hollowed out by this fiat currency policy.
Do you see any rationality on the horizon of leadership in the country going in that direction?
There's a great quotation that maybe I can pull up. Well, I don't have it right in front of me, but basically, you know, governments frequently don't do the smart thing. You know, they get pressured into it. It's kind of the theme of it. So, and unfortunately, a lot of this hinges on, you know, our populace having knowledge of economics and politics. And, you know, most people are just slogging through their jobs and trying to make ends meet, and they really don't want to be bothered with this. And unfortunately, I think, you know, people are learning these lessons the hard way. And the 19th century, people were really aware of these issues. Now we're completely oblivious, and we're just, you know, unfortunately, going to learn it the hard way, I think.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think at least it's a step in the right direction. People really have focused more on these issues than they had at the previous 10 years or 15 years, for sure.
Yeah, it was a wake-up call, and I think, you know, the message that comes out of this is that maybe, you know, your question about is there something good about the intervention, maybe, you know, by putting things on hold for a little while, some of us out here can get the message and try to get our house in order and, you know, try to save more and try not to borrow as much and so forth and so on. That I think, could be, you know, an opening for some people to improve their situation.
Well, we've been speaking with William Baker, the author of Endless Money, The Moral Hazards of Socialism. Bill, is there a website that people can go to?
Yeah, the book has a website, readendless.com. And like I said earlier, I have an economics website called conservativeeconomist.com, where there are ongoing comments like that Howard Dean essay that I'm mentioning.
That's it for this week's edition of What's at Risk. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, James Rudolph of Rudolph Friedman and William Baker, the author of Endless Money. I'd like to thank our producer, Johnny Pfister of Ringo Studio, and our associate producer, Scott Cooper. We're interested in what you're thinking about. Send us an email at whatsatrisk@risk-strategies.com and let us know what's on your mind. Be sure to visit the What's at Risk show library at wbz.com. Go to the Watch and Listen drop-down menu, then click on What's at Risk.
You've been listening to What's at Risk, heard every Saturday night on WBZ News Radio 1030 and streaming on WBZ.com.
Run the risk.